you. Okay, so, first of all, thank you for inviting me over here. Nice to see you all here today. You always, in Perth, you always hear about the Buddhist site of Victoria, because I understand it is the oldest Buddhist site in Australia, is that right, Cora? Yeah?
Exactly.
Yeah, that's right. So, started back in 1950s or something?
I think we're the second oldest, technically, but they're all still operating as a Buddhist centre. The Sydney one's a library. It was a little bit older.
Okay. It's good to be here. So this is where Buddhism pretty much started in Australia. So that's very auspicious and very nice. And it's also wonderful that now you are moving on towards establishing a forest monastery. The Buddha said many beautiful things about living in the forest, about the Sangha living in the forest in particular. And in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the Buddha says quite specifically that if the monastic Sangha lives in the forest and practices in the forest, then you can expect that Buddhism will last for a long time into the future. So this idea of forest dwelling, living away from the city, is an integral part of the Buddhist practice. And without that, you can actually expect the decline of Buddhism without that. So it's a wonderful thing that you're moving that direction. You're moving towards the sustaining of Buddhism for the long term in the future by doing this. It's a great thing. We already have it very well established in Perth. It's funny, isn't it, how Perth is kind of this minor city on the fringe of Australia, whereas Melbourne is more kind of the centre of things. But sometimes that's the way it goes. So now it's wonderful to see you going in the same direction. So, for today's Dhamma talk, I'm going to read some suttas for you. I'm not going to really read them. I'm going to talk about some suttas. I'm going to read a little bit and explain these things. And the reason I want to do that is that I always regard understanding the word of the Buddha very fundamental for anyone who is a Buddhist. This is where, at the end of the day, we should draw our inspirations in the word of the Buddha. This is where, if you have any conflict, any lack of understanding, you find maybe two teachers saying opposite things. If you want to resolve anything, you don't want to understand what Buddhism is all about, this is where you have to go. And sometimes people think that the sutta, oh, so scary, you know, I can't understand what is in there, it's too difficult, maybe I have to learn Pali first, all these kind of things. But actually the reality is, it's not that scary at all. The suttas are quite accessible, even for ordinary people. Sometimes you read a sutta and it's like it speaks to you directly, right? It's almost, the Buddha existed 2,500 years ago, a different culture, different time, and still, even though that is the case, still this sutta speaks directly to us. And that is the genius of the Buddha, that's the power of the Buddha. He speaks across time, across culture, because he speaks to the human condition. It doesn't matter what background you have, it doesn't matter what era of, his history you come from. He speaks to what it means to be human. And because it speaks to that, it is possible for us to relate to these teachings directly in the present day. And so these things are very powerful for that reason. And one of the things that always occurs to me as well about the suttas is that the Buddha must have got it right. Right? If the Buddha didn't have it right, if he got it wrong, well, there's no hope for the rest of us. Then the whole of Buddhism kind of collapses like a house of cards. Because all of Buddhism, the whole history of Buddhism, is built on the foundation that the Buddha had an insight into reality, an understanding of what things are actually like. That is what the whole thing is built up on. So if the Buddha got it wrong, it means that the rest isn't that interesting. So the assumption in Buddhism is always that the Buddha had it right. And because he had it right, it's very useful to go back to his teachings. Sometimes you may have doubts whether any particular monk or nun has got it right. I sit up here. Most of you have probably never seen me before. You wonder, who is this fellow coming from Perth, And fair enough, maybe you should think like that. That's a good way of thinking. You should always be a little bit, not skeptical, but you shouldn't be kind of, you shouldn't have your kind of stupid kind of faith just because someone is a monk or whatever. So it's good to listen, and then if it matches with the word of the Buddha, good. If it doesn't, well then, you should always, at the end of the day, rely on the word of the Buddha as your refuge. That is the triple refuge, what it's all about. So let us have a look at some of these suttas that I picked for today. And the first one is actually about this particular topic, why it is so important to listen to the word of the Buddha. That's what the first sutta is about. It's a pretty short little thing. Now I'll just read it out for you, and then I will explain what is happening here. So this is the Buddha speaking to the monks. Because there are these five future perils as yet unarisen that will arise in the future. We should recognize them and make an effort to abandon them. What are these five? So I will take one of these five. This is number four. And the Buddha says, because in the future there will be monks who are undeveloped in body, undeveloped in virtuous behavior, undeveloped in mind, and undeveloped in wisdom. Doesn't sound very good, does it? When those discourses spoken by the Tathagata are being recited that are deep, deep in meaning, world transcending, connected with emptiness, they will not want to listen to them, lend an ear to them, or apply their minds to understand them. They will not think those teachings should be studied and learned. But when those discourses are being recited that are mere poetry, composed by poets, beautiful in words and phrases, created by outsiders, spoken by disciples, they will want to listen to them, lend an ear to them, apply their minds to understand them, and they will think those teachings should be studied and learned. Thus, because through the defilement of the Dhamma comes defilement of the discipline, and from defilement of the discipline comes defilement of the Dhamma. Thus is the fourth peril in the future, as yet unarisen, that will arise in the future. You should recognize it and make an effort to abandon it. So here you can see the Buddha makes this distinction between the teachings of the Buddha and the teachings of someone who is not. And the teaching of the Buddha have all these special qualities, right? And this is what makes them so so interesting. And whereas the other people who are listed here, you are at a certain degree of uncertainty about these teachings. So you can see here the sort of things that he says. The teachings, discourses that are mere poetry, composed by poets, beautiful in words and phrases, right? And this is a tendency of the human mind. We tend to like things that are beautiful, tend to like things that sound right, things that kind of are, you know, because this is the human mind, we move towards the beautiful things of the world, towards sensuality, basically, towards things that are attractive. But that is not necessarily where you find the deepest meaning, right? The purpose of the Buddhist teachings is actually to have a deep meaning. And this is what it says here at the beginning, teachings that are deep and deep in meaning. Sometimes things can seem deep on the surface. You think, wow, that is profound, right? Like some of these sayings that people come up with that sound, what was that? A famous Indian guru who turned out to be a bit of a scallywag later on, Rajneesh, right? He said something, I'm so detached, I'm not even attached to detachment, or something like that. And it sounds very kind of, when you hear it, it sounds, wow, this is very profound, right? But is it really profound, or is it just kind of a clever wording? And if you think about it, it really is just a clever wording, and it isn't really very profound. But the teachings of the Buddha, not only are they deep, when they appear deep, but they are deep, they have a deep meaning, there's something beautiful there. And that is why they need to be investigated and looked at, and I will look at that afterwards. And this is the difference between something which is beautiful on the surface and something which is truly beautiful, because the message underneath is powerful and beautiful. That is a beautiful thing. A message which is truly beautiful is a message which has the ability to transform you, right? To make you to a better person, to make you have less suffering in life, to have more happiness in life. This is a truly beautiful message. And this is what we're talking about. We're talking about the teachings of the Buddha. So, this is the first thing about his teachings. They are deep and deep in meaning, world transcending, right? This is the thing which makes you kind of, it makes you so content and so happy eventually as you practice this path. It's a gradual movement upwards. It makes you so content that eventually it's like you leave this world behind. And by this world, we mean the human realm, where there is a lot of suffering, there's lots of problems, there's all kind of issues that we always have to deal with. You leave all these problems behind and you move into a state of purity and great satisfaction and contentment and fulfillment. This is the thing that we are really yearning for, isn't it? Fulfillment. Feeling complete inside. Not feeling this lack which is always there. if you ask yourself what craving is all about, craving is a sense of emptiness inside. It's like a hole that needs to be filled, right? And craving said, if you run after this, if you follow after this, if you get this, whatever it is, then that hole inside of you, this feeling of emptiness inside of you, will be filled up. But that is the promise of craving. That's what it's kind of pushing you to do. But actually, it doesn't work. You run after the thing, and then you get it, and then you find the hole is still there, and you crave more, right? And new craving too says, if you get me, then you will be happy. So we do it again. And still, it is there, right? And we do this again and again and again. And eventually, if we have a bit of wisdom, particularly with the help of the Buddha's teachings, we realize that this hole, this craving inside of us, cannot be filled by simply getting the object of that craving. An object is never going to fulfill us. We have to fulfill us. We have to get the sense of completeness inside in a different way. And what is that way? That is the Buddhist path is all about. When you practice the Buddhist path, gradually, gradually, you grow in contentment, you grow in happiness, suffering goes down, you crave less for the world because you have more happiness inside of you. More happiness inside of you means less desire externally because you're already fulfilled, right? And then gradually you feel a sense of fulfillment inside. And this degree of fulfillment increases, increases, increases until craving kind of drops down at the same time. One goes up, craving goes down. And as this happens, you start to feel fulfilled inside. And you start to feel that the purpose of life is being fulfilled there. You're actually reaching that sense of, wow, this is it. The meaning of life is starting to become apparent to you. And you're actually reaching that meaning of life. What a beautiful thing that is. This is what it means. It's world transcending. You go beyond this world of craving and desires to a sense of fulfillment in a much higher state of mind, which is all about. That's a wonderful message. That's a beautiful message. Feeling fulfilled, feeling complete. It's such a... When you think about that, it's, wow, this is all I'm really after in life. This is what life is all about. And now I'm getting it fulfilled. So world transcending, connected with emptiness. And this is the idea, of course, the Buddhist idea of non-self, right? It's connected with emptiness. And when you read the suttas, the Buddha will always say that there is one thing that distinguishes the Buddhist teaching from all other teachings in the world. That is this idea of non-self. In Buddhism, we have this idea of non-self. And nothing else, no other teachings really have this idea of non-self in quite the same way. As the Buddhist teaching. So the Buddha actually teaches this emptiness, and that's what you find in the suttas. And this emptiness is then one of the highest teachings of Buddhism. It's good to know that sometimes the idea of emptiness is glorified into some kind of very special teaching. But the idea of emptiness, certainly in early Buddhism in the suttas, just means that the lack of a self, the lack of a permanent entity inside, that's essentially what it means. That's what you find in the Buddha's teachings. And then instead of being interested in that, right? If you don't understand what this is why I'm trying to bring these things out and show you how profound these things are. Because sometimes you read the teachings of the Buddha and you don't get this kind of thing. And because you don't get it, you think, yeah, whatever, you know, I'd rather read some poetry or whatever. And this is what the Buddha says afterwards. You read the poetry, beautiful words and phrases, that which is created by outsiders. And sometimes you find that even Buddhist people, they find more inspiration in teachings that are outside of Buddhism rather than in the beautiful word of the Buddha. I've seen that among monastics. Some monastics kind of read all kind of stuff and they're not, sometimes they kind of lose interest in the word of the Buddha. And of course you can see where that is heading. That is heading eventually you end up disrobing because you're not really feeling like a Buddhist anymore. So the outsiders, from a Buddhist point of view, and I think that is my experience, that the Buddha's teaching is something special about them that I can relate to. It's very difficult to find elsewhere. And then lastly, the most interesting thing here to me is this idea spoken by disciples, right? How people tend to elevate the speeches of disciples. Disciples means all of us here, right? Including the monks and the nuns and every one of us. Elevate the teachings of the disciples often above the word of the Buddha. One of the fascinating things I always find is that when you look around the world and you ask people, who is your teacher in Buddhism? And what do people, I mentioned this the other day when some people were over here. What do people say? Who is your teacher? Okay, people say, my teacher is Bhaktivinoda Ratana, you know, the famous Sri Lankan monk in the US. My teacher is Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese monk in France. My teacher is Ajahn Sumedho in England. My teacher is Mahasi Sayadaw in Burma. It's you know, Ajahn Shah in Thailand, whatever. And we, it's Ajahn Brahm, of course, not the one, where it's Venerable Jang, or whatever it is, right? Where today it's me. But, you know, it's like, these are my, have you ever heard anybody say that Buddha is my teacher? Nobody ever says that, right? And that is very fascinating, because in the end, it's the word of the Buddha everything goes back to. And yet nobody takes the Buddha as their teacher. And what a shame that is, because these are the best teachings. And precisely, this is the danger, precisely, that the Buddha warned us against here, right? You listen to the disciples, and then kind of, if you're lucky and you have time to read a verse in the Dhammapada, that's about as far as you go with the teachings of the Buddha. What a shame that is, and we have these wonderful teachings there. And keep that in mind. I'm not saying you shouldn't listen to contemporary teachers or other teachers. I'm not saying you shouldn't listen to those at all. What I'm saying is that there is a hierarchy. That hierarchy is that the teaching of the Buddha should come first, and then should come the teachings of others, right? So there is a clear sequence there. So in the end, your ultimate inspiration should always come from the Buddha. And one of the problems, if you listen too much to teachers that came after the time of the Buddha, contemporary teachers or even ancient teachers, like, you know, very often even Theravada Buddhists, instead of reading the suttas, they will read the Sutta in Magga, or they will read the Abhidhamma, or they will read the commentaries, all these kind of things. But that is the same thing. All that is also the teaching of the disciples and not the teachings of the Buddha. So please keep that in mind. And then when you remember that, then you go back to the suttas and you think, wow, this is where my root inspiration goes. And if there is a clash in opinion between different teachers, as there often is, the other night I was having a debate with Stephen Batchelor at Augustine, was it Augustine Hall or something, yeah? And that was exactly that, it was a clash of opinion, right? He says that rebirth is not so important, I say it is very important, and then there was a disagreement. Okay, so what do? You have to go back to the suttas. And I recommend you to go back to the suttas to find a solution to these kind of problems, because many problems can be resolved quite easily in that.